All right, so today we have Brian Leonard joining with us. So why don't you kick right off and talk about your career history to start?
Yes, hello, my name is Brian Leonard. I started out growing up in Texas, went to school in South Carolina, had the opportunity, which I recommend to everybody, to do a bunch of internships at Clemson, where I went to school. We called them co-ops because you were allowed to do them in the spring and fall, and I did those in several places throughout the country, ending my last internship at IBM. Stayed on with them in Boston working for Lotus. Lotus Notes still has 100 million users out there, and I made it better in my time there for 5 to 6 years. While there, I met a lady that I worked with, and she had this idea about people on the internet helping each other through social networking and such that eventually became TaskRabbit. I was the technical co-founder there. I'm 10 years into that journey now. And, you know, we've been acquired by IKEA. We've quadrupled the team since then. So continued investment, and we're growing all over. So, you know, that's ongoing and very exciting.
Great. So going back to the very early days, what kinds of things were you playing around with? Hardware, software, those kinds of things. What got you interested in tech?
I remember, you know, this is the, let's see, where are we? The mid 90s or so. And like, I was at one of those career counseling things. And it never dawned on me before. People said I was good at math, so I should be an engineer. And I was told that meant like bridges or something. And at some point I realized that I could actually just play with computers all the time. At the time, to me, that meant like Civilization, the game where you take over the world. I was a big fan of that. Just generally creating things, you know, Harvard graphics I had at the time. I don't know, all kinds of just things that you could make. And eventually I realized that you could do that. And then eventually I started making websites. I was the owner of studentcouncil.com for a while, for our local high school student council. I should have kept it, probably worth something now. And I made that website, but I did it so exhaustingly. Like, I crafted every page profile for all 200 members. So sometime right after that, I discovered databases and started building things with those. And PHP in particular was a beautiful thing. And on from there.
Cool. It sounds like you're on a really applied learning track. Like, certainly you could learn for the sake of learning, but when it's to solve a problem, it makes it that much more relevant and kind of gets you on a flywheel of like, well, all right, let's solve some more problems. What do I need to learn? There's an inverted way, which is just to learn for the sake of learning, but it doesn't stick as much, right?
The former, yeah. You know, in the meantime, going to college, you know, it was, you know, algorithms and Java and, you know, big O notation and all those sort of things, which, you know, paid off, but it was always better when I was trying to have an outcome for me.
Absolutely. I can totally relate to that. So you said you spent a lot of time at TaskRabbit since you were the technical co-founder, and it sounds like there's been tremendous growth. You said the team 4X'd. What's the org look like today?
Yeah. So when we were acquired in around this time, 2 years ago, 2017, we were 60 people. Let's see, 12 engineers. You know, on the order of 20 something in engineering, design, data, and product. And now we are, you know, 250 or so with 40-ish engineers, you know, and more management there, and more, a lot more data science and products and stuff. And so we also have probably a higher percentage of operations and support than a lot of pure I don't know, SaaS companies or something like that, because we've got all kinds of logistical things going out on out in the world.
Yeah.
You know, people are getting lost and breaking things and looking for all kinds of things, and people aren't showing up. And it, you know, one of the things I learned very early on is that the test suite always passes. Everything's green. Everything works perfectly. It's really the humans that
who will test the testers
are unpredictable. Nobody. If you were, I had a presentation I gave a long time ago that like showed a test suite and then showed what it would look like if you interpreted it for the real world, and basically it has randomness, and it was never green, because, you know, people show up not when they expect and all these other things. Anyway, I got distracted. No, so we have you know, sort of 50 to 60 people in sort of engineering, design, data, and product now, and then operations, and we're building out a partnerships team, and a customer support, and you know, just a growing company that's recruiting great people to do the work, and marketing, you know, a new category of things to people that aren't used to having the internet solve these problems for them.
Yep, yep. Yeah, so in that span, I'm sure you saw some tremendous growth with people. And nine or 10 years is a long time. And one of my advisors back in the day was like, you're never going to finish up with who you start with. But surprisingly, I just visited my last company. I was there for 5 years and just met with a bunch of old folks today. And there's a probably 5 to 10% of the engineering not founders, but they're in the starting team. Along your way, have you had any engineers stick with you for a long time? And what kind of, you know, growth stories did they have? You know, I'm looking for, like, they started from here, then they got into it, and then they wound up here, you know, higher up somewhere.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it's been a long journey. There's some people with us that were there pre-acquisition, but I am obviously by far the ranking member of the team in general, much less the engineering team. But over the years, we had at some point, like I said, we were acquired, we were only 12 engineers. And there were people that were there for 5+ years at that time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the one that comes to mind, is just sort of in the biggest journey for me, was he started as an intern. At IBM, I ran a program in Boston for interns called Extreme Blue. And it was just sort of this notion that extreme, like IBM, could still be hip, you know? And it was a recruiting tactic, really. And, you know, they more or less worked on whatever they wanted to work on. And so even when we were 4 engineers, myself included, in 2011 maybe, I said, all right, we're going to have some internships, and we can, you know, get some people to help us here. And I put out a call, and for whatever reason, I got a lot of people from France applying, and their friends and their friends. And first, and I just, we ended up hiring 4 French engineers interns, which was half the team at that point. And I followed the same model at the beginning, which was let them work on whatever they wanted to work on and just use their innate creativity. It turns out that didn't work in startups, because by definition, I was working on things that were longer lead or not critical path or something like that. And I just didn't have the time to help scope out a project that we thought would be interesting if, you know, we did Facebook this and that and knew who your friends were using and recommended. But if it wasn't on the critical path, then it's not worth talking about. So we very quickly got them in the normal flow and projects and, say, Pivotal Tracker or something like that. And then 2 of those we hired full time. And then both of those were with us for 4+ years, maybe more after that. One until very recently. And, you know, they were Ruby to begin with. One of them became an iOS engineer in the process. The other one kicked off a React Native project that we did that was very successful, you know, and transformed what his interests were and what he's working on, you know, going from intern to a senior engineer, both of them with green cards. And it was a great journey.
Okay, wow, that's great growth along the way to be such a, you know, like a senior engineer just in the span of 4 or 5 years. Along the way, you know, beyond just challenging people to bigger and bigger things, did you have any programs or incentives or challenges to people that took them outside their comfort zone and maybe got like a multiplier level growth in what they were doing?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, even just switching to that new technology is a growth opportunity for people. But when you take that to the next level and write about it on our blog, you know, particularly if you're not even a native English speaker, that's definitely outside of the comfort zone. But one of our engineers, JR, he you know, became relatively famous in those early days of React Native by posting it on the blog. Overall, that was a great thing for us. At some point, our tech blog got more hits than our normal blog, and the PR team started paying attention. We ranked above the Rails site for certain Rails keywords.
Wow!
at one point, which was also good for recruiting, and so, you know, that. Teaching the team what you know. You know, we had something called, well, our company had something called that I started on very early called Lunch and Learn. And, you know, eventually that became Lurch, Learn and Lunch. And so we've had lunches on, you know, music and, you know, the law behind, you know, promotional contests. We've had all kinds of speakers and things come in and talk. But then the engineers, we called it Dornch, dorky lunch and learn and lunches. And then they would teach about, you know, Docker or parallel Ruby processing or TypeScript. We tricked the team into one of those, tricked the team into using that recently. And, you know, those are really good opportunities to grow, you know, in more directions than just the technical one.
That's great. And there's such a multiplier effect, especially to the blogging and anything that's public, because you hit the nail on the head. It's a PR effort. And especially when it comes to attracting talent, there's a lot of choices of places to go. And with your engineering blog out in the open, I don't know if you noticed this with some of your hires. We used to do the same thing. And some of our hires would say, well, I joined this team because I figured out what it was going to be like to work there by looking at your migration from AWS to your own data center and by looking at your YTypeScript blog. And there's a whole bunch of engineers. Every month we'd have somebody talk about something cool they're working on. And it really was a cool way to build a model in people's heads or a picture of what it was like to work with us. And you know, secondly, the lunch and learns, the lunches, as you say, it's a great multiplier there too, because at least the dorky ones that are based on tech, more than just being sort of neuroplastic and cognitively stimulating, it's still also about tech as well. And that's a great way, because if you're presenting, you got to prepare and have your stuff together, right? You need to know about it. So it's a good exercise in the preparation. It's also a good exercise on the absorption side as well. So that's really cool stuff.
Yeah, in addition to the hiring, which we heard, and it was great to, when someone says, like, how does your architecture work, or like, what do you think is important? You know, I actually posted them to public blog posts. That was super helpful. We found it also in helpful in onboarding. So for a while we had the same Jekyll sort of blogging platform. We had like an internal folder that is sort of like you might use a wiki or a Confluence or something like that. And we found that people were willing to do documentation more when they thought of it like a blog post as opposed to a documentation. And I think the main difference is they weren't committing to keeping it up to date forever and ever. And so they were willing to write down like how something worked when it was time stamped, you know, December 5th, 2016, as opposed to sort of signing up for that debt forever. And then some of those then became public and some stayed internal.
Yeah, excellent. So going to the time span when you were there, I'm sure your mission has changed a lot over time. Maybe you could summarize how the arc of that changed from the beginning until now.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you actually look at us today, it's actually very similar to in 2008, 2009. You know, we were about neighbors helping neighbors. You know, there had to be a better way to get things done. You know, somebody might be at the store right now and could pick something up on the way home. We could provide jobs. People could use their skills. It was in the middle of the housing crisis to get some extra cash. And on the other side, we could, you know, help people spend their time like they wanted to. You know, our gift cards actually still say, that code doesn't change very often. It's like, give the gift of time, like that sort of thing. And then over time, I think one thing that's really interesting is, you know, we were so small and we had this thing, and as like things got bigger and more serious, and we moved to Silicon Valley. We were in Boston when we started, and like it became something just a little more like Silicon Valley, the show maybe, or something like that, right? It was about revolutionizing how work gets done or something like that. It was a revolution. It couldn't just be neighbors helping neighbors, you know, and Uber was coming up, and there was just revolutions and disruptions and all these sorts of things. And, you know, it kind of swayed that way as, you know, we were sort of in that phase of, whatever version of web X.0 or whatever you call 2015 or so. And what's kind of interesting of what's happened more recently is a lot of those companies went out of business. They raised way more than us, you know, had a crazy few years and then moved on. It's actually become more about neighbors helping neighbors again recently. And, you know, helping everyday people with their everyday lives, and about, we call it task management networks, just managing all of these things through the network effects, and it being not push button, somebody shows up at your house. It's about forming relationships. It's not about TaskRabbit solving all your problems. When I look at a shelf sitting on the ground and wishing it was up on the wall, you know, it's great if they think TaskRabbit, but it's even better for our clients to think, you know, Sandra would be perfect to put this up, and they hit a button and now they're talking with someone they worked with before and trust and let into their house. And so to some degree, it's come full circle.
Yeah. And I remember early in the day, we used TaskRabbit several times to set up offices. That's why it's kind of ironic. IKEA bought you, but maybe not. It must've been a good fit, because several times in Soma, in South Park and so forth, we had a couple different places, and yeah, it was really just right down the street.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, it's kind of surprising with IKEA and not surprising. You know, TaskRabbit has a category creation challenge. You know, our surveys show that a fairly small percentage of people like instinctually think of the internet to solve their problems at home, like that shelf sitting on the ground that I just talked about. At the same time, you've got a channel in IKEA with billions of people hitting their websites, hundreds of millions of people walking through their stores that very clearly need something that we've done organically hundreds and hundreds of thousands of times. Your office, my house, you know, more people's offices and houses. And so, you know, the fit made a lot of sense.
Okay, so let's change gears over into a little more specifics around growth. So I'm curious if there's been, you know, if there's been a situation where you've had to maybe stand up for your team. I don't know the dynamics of your co-founders and your CEO and stuff, but has there been ever any tension between like, oh my gosh, we're in a crunch. Let's throw some of our ethos out the window so that we can produce something, or where, you know, the other things in the company got in the way of fostering growth and so forth.
Interesting. I think the management team starting, with Leah, the founder, and myself, was never particularly combative in that way. That maybe you're hinting at, but there's always this trade-off, fairly famous, between, quality, scope, and time. And, it's like one of these pick two situations, right? I think we're always trying to make those trade-offs. In particular, that's tough when the time becomes fixed, usually with external commitment of some sort. We committed to partner X that we would have this by, February 1st, or now with IKEA, there's, stakeholders that are used to working that way, and maybe not with startups that, we sort of have those deadlines, basically. And, we have to manage the scope and quality, nobody wants to crash. And so we usually go after scope first. A hard choice we're making as we're launching in these countries which have deadlines right now, of when we're going to launch in Germany, when we're going to launch in Spain, is around our language support. And are we allowing people to switch languages or not? And we're trying, it's one thing that's ongoing right now. If you can launch in Switzerland and switch between, French, German and Italian or whatever. We're cutting some corners in the scope of what's possible there. Hopefully not cutting the overall experience, features, mm-hmm. not bugs, I guess is our general goal.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's actually talk about scaling. So you mentioned earlier you had a really lean and mean org size around 12 or so, which actually is amazing. I never thought that your team was so lean and mean in that regard. And that's a good thing. And then later you said that with the acquisition and so forth, you added a whole bunch more. And so I think it's probably fair to assume you had to scale the management layers on the inside as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe can you talk about that process and maybe the kinds of people you hired there and how your focus changed and so forth?
Yeah. So at acquisition, I was the CTO, and we had a VPE named Paul. It was great. And, he was managing the 12 engineers, basically. and I was, involved with, I looked at most things that went out, code review, and helped the team and, paired or gave feedback or, even built some of the things. Over the next 2 years, we now have... trying to 12 to 1 is not the best ratio. I think 7 to 1 feels pretty good. And after 10, you start not mentoring as much as you want. At one point I was managing 18, actually, a long time ago.
Yeah.
Which was out of control. We're scaling the team in that way. So we have pods that are working, all reporting to a manager, and trying to keep the ratio about that. And so now we have, it's 5-ish managers, and a director and the VP and me. And what I love about that size is that a lot of those managers are like kind of, they really know what's going on. They're the ones, looking at the code, even committing a little bit, kind of some of them are playing player coach roles and, just really doing whatever it takes to make that team successful. And they're able to do that by keeping those, that ratio lower than it was before.
Yeah, definitely. And I agree with you about optimal team size hovering right there around 7. So my question is, did these managers and directors and so forth come in with their own set of ideas about how to take care of individual contributors, and or did you as well? How did that mix? How did that sort of influence how the experience went for the individual contributor when they went from having, say, you as a manager to your VP of engineering to, as it's scaling, like sort of as the space-time or whatever is getting, everything's getting further apart. Like how are you maintaining that mojo as you're growing?
Yeah. It's interesting. The first thing to know is that it was probably a step up from me to the VPE by definition. Going from, personalities aside, going from, someone that's trying to drive the technical thing and manage the people to somebody that's really focused just on the people. If my inherent sensibilities have me thinking more about the database than the engineer, finding someone that was the other way around to yin and yang that situation was definitely a step up. But then as we scaled, the thing that's interesting was, you're sitting in a meeting and, more than half the team has been there less than a year. And so I'm a big fan of this, I forget the guy's name that did it, but the forming, storming, norming, performing framework. You heard this before?
Yes, vaguely.
And so, like, there's this form. The team comes together, and then there's some shakeout, the storming phase, where everyone has to kind of figure out their role in this new team, and then they create norms, and then they perform. The caveat is that every time someone new joins a team, it's a new team, and that so there's a lot of storming that has to go place when that's happening weekly, certainly monthly, and then and all the team is basically new by the end of a year. Everyone's been there less than a year. I mean, one or two people that from before, and so there's this new norms that need to be created per team and then per organization. And we had to, give a disproportionate amount of time before, when we had a bunch of people that had been there 5 years and just how we do things. We were firmly in that performing phase, to talk about why those were like they were, and be willing to rethink it based on the new experiences of the teams coming in. Each team gets its own norms, then which of those are good to bubble up and sort of propagate to the other four teams in the organization. And then five teams, et cetera, et cetera. And so, we're still 2 years in, just getting to the point where, we're still trying things out. Like, we're maybe half the teams are on Jira right now and half the teams are on Tracker, and we're still deciding. Like, that's just one point among 100 of sort of understanding how we do things, but getting better every step of the way.
Interesting. Are they all based in one place or geo-distributed, or?
Yeah, so another part of trying to ramp up that quickly is that it's both, I think our recruiter came up to us at one point and said, probably in 2018, like, I'm pretty sure we've emailed every human being that has Ruby on their LinkedIn in the Bay Area. So, I think we in general, we need different tactics, right? And so we started looking distributed. We have offices in Austin and New York and London. But, over the last 2 years, we've hired engineers working in Seattle, New Orleans, Virginia, Chicago, sort of all over. So part of that was finding those people, and then still some in our office, and then secondarily we've been experimenting with contractors. to fill the gaps. There's just a lot to do. Long-term contractors, and they're in Egypt and Eastern Europe and Mexico and all kinds of things. And so, you know, we've definitely gone distributed in the process.
Yeah. What a change in culture when that happens. Cause I assume at least early on you were in one office, one HQ.
Yeah, definitely.
And then now you have folks all over the world and in many time zones and a lot of people who are working from home, essentially full time, short of when you, I don't know, fly them in for offsites or whatever.
That's right.
But is there a little bit of stories there to the transition? Because it doesn't go smoothly sometimes when you go from an in the office kind of culture to a distributed one. Any right. takeaways there?
Yeah, even at acquisition, we had a few people distributed, but they had all been in the office, and so I think step one in our journey was having an engineer that's been with us for several years, and we like them and have been doing great. And like for a variety of reasons, you know, they want to move to some other place. And being like, you know, sure. That sounds, you know, we'd rather have you in Salt Lake City than not have you at all or whatever
right,
it is.
Right, right.
And so that was step one. And there's a set of things and, you know, even just then, like not being second class and simple things like upgrading our video conferencing equipment are important. I have a friend that worked at Automattic, the WordPress company, and they're very into this whole thing. And one thing he told me always stuck with me is that he was in a meeting, or he was sitting around a table with six people that worked at the company. And all of a sudden they all just got up and left. And he's like, what's going on? And nobody had been talking for the last 20 minutes, but they'd all been discussing where they were going to go to lunch. But they were sort of a remote distributed first kind of team that they'd actually been discussing it on ICQ or HipChat or Slack or whatever, depending on whatever year it was. and he wasn't tuned to that. But that's how that company works. So part of it is documenting more, doing more on, recorded channels, asynchronous channels and that. And then, you know, as we grew and grew, we just had to keep leaning into that whole situation and, you know, sort of create a set of ways of working that that felt inclusive. At least one that I really try to do every meeting. We're sort of going around the table or you're brainstorming or something like that. And it's just that you're going around the table and you can tell when somebody wants to say something with eye contact and sort of gestures or
they
something
call it
like
gup, yeah, they call it guppying, where you have your mouth open, you're like ready to talk, take a big breath exactly. to talk, you know.
Now all the coaches I've ever had says that I should probably be listening, but we all do that too, right? Like we're all like but you know, taking that moment and essentially checking with the people that are on the Google Meet or Hangout or Zoom or whatever we're using is one thing that we definitely have on the list and that I find super important to make sure that the voices are heard and the best ideas come out.
Yeah, excellent. So another question, you talked about folks who were looking to move to other places and so forth. And did you start any new offices with folks that you shipped out or that wanted to move there anyways?
I lived in Austin for a while myself. I worked at IBM on Dernit. We didn't do that. Well, that's not true. Not in engineering, we didn't do that. They were in their house, essentially. With customer support, we did do that actually, specifically in Austin. We started hiring remote, distributed team from their houses in Austin. And at some point we got a critical mass and now we have a 50 person office or something like that in Austin with not just customer support, but operations in general.
That's cool. So I guess that dovetails into the next question, which was, you know, with these folks that are in your org, sometimes up to 5 years or more, I'm talking on the engineering side, mm-hmm. surely some have gotten to a burnout track. What do you do with folks that are stuck in a rut, and how can you get them out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've not just the people in the org, you know, myself, everyone included. It's important. And, you know, I think that a lot of people would say, and I certainly believe that learning is the key, sort of path out of that, you know, rut, so to speak, to get back on the, I don't know where this metaphor is going, but the high ground, whatever's out right outside the rut. I think that's, and change and learning are important. And so I think, you know, anytime we're looking for a new position on another team, you know, having that open to someone else on the team that's on a, you know, if they're in the, we have a client facing group now, you know, we're hiring on our tasker facing group, the people that do the work on our platform, you know, certainly that's open. We have somebody right now transitioning from the tasker team to a partnerships team that we're forming right now. One of the amazing benefits of working at a growing company, and why a lot of people choose startups in the face of, you know, less pay and, you know, lottery ticket odds and these things, is that, you know, those battlefield promotions or changes and, you know, sort of being able to write your own job description and sort of moving into those as the company grows. So I think that's definitely one. And even on the same team, you know, looking for new technologies and learning in that space is important too. And, you know, I think as a manager, it's important to understand sort of a learning agenda, define and understand a learning agenda for everybody in the org. Then actively look for places that make sense. We're not going to switch to Go or something because, you know, engineer A wants to learn Go. But, you know, to know that they're interested in, you know, functional programming or something like that, and then a use case comes up for that, then this would be perfect for, you know, that engineer to try out this thing. I think it's everyone's job in the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. Starting with probably your engineer managers, because they're the ones that are closest to the ICs, and hopefully one-on-one-ing and having the comms necessary to know people that well.
Yeah,
and
ideally, we'd like to say starting with the engineer themselves also.
True. Yeah, for sure.
Owning that, not being presented with opportunities, but, you know, advocating for what they need. Like, you know, we try to say that, you know, if you're looking for something new, a raise, a new technology, you're starting to feel burnt out. You know, part of that responsibility lies with you and having that, you own the agenda on your one-on-ones.
Exactly. And that's a big part of effective one-on-ones, along with aligning the interests of the company and the individual with the growth plan.
Exactly.
Cool. So with respect to the engineer managers and director or directors that you've hired, did you promote them through the ranks, or did you hire them from outside, or a mix of both?
A mix of both. We've had, you know, looking at our current organization, we've had a VPE brought in from Intuit, Sadipa. He's doing great. We've had some engineering managers we've hired in, and we've had engineering managers who were hired in and then promoted to higher positions, and then we've had engineers themselves that have become managers.
Yes.
And we also have, I think it's very important to have, you know, a technical track too for success. We've had, you know, engineers go from, you know, the bottom of that ladder to the top of the you know, to senior to staff level engineers.
That's great. Let's focus on the folks that were engineers first and sort of jumped across the ladder to the management ladder side of things. Mm-hmm. I call it a lateral, And somebody else in the series said, that's not a promotion. And I can kind of agree with that.
Yeah, I do agree with that.
You know, and actually another participant said they tried in their org to like have it be not a demotion, but like you start at the bottom of the ladder in the pay grade again, but HR wouldn't let them do that. I could see why, but if you could maybe, you know, what was the friction points, or did some ease into it, or did they need coaches or a guild at the EM level? Like how did that go for some? That's what I'm really interested in.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree with the ladder role notion, but nobody really likes the pay cut either. That's not a great message.
Yeah, it never happened, but it was just for an analogy this person made. But go ahead, sorry.
No, that's fine. You know, I mean, I see this with myself too, right? Like, you know, you can say I was the technical co-founder or the VP or director of engineering or the CTO or whatever, but at some point, you know, I transitioned from a majority of my time coding to a majority of my time, you know, doing people-related things, you know, one-on-ones and coaching and whatnot. And so during that transition, with the managers that we've seen that, and you know, I don't like to speak for other people's feelings, and so I can only speak for my own feelings. But like, you know, I certainly felt a tension. And there's a piece of it that's about letting go. That's, you know, the people you're now coaching and mentoring and trying to help them grow, you know, maybe they wouldn't have built it exactly like you would have built it. And it was challenging for me to have those discussions in a way that felt constructive. Fortunately, I got a lot of coaching help. The company, you know, we brought in, you know, executive coaches for these sorts of things. And we have a whole bunch of training stuff we do here that was very helpful. And over time, I've learned to lead more with the why and the story and the context and couch my words more around like in particular we have culture and norms and words become very important. So we have one here, which is there's a finite lexicon difference between the words idea, proposal, and decision. And so like just an idea just means like, you know, I'm just a normal guy chatting here, right? Sure. And a proposal is like, here's what I think we should do, like react to this and let me know if this is good or bad or whatever. And decision like here's the plan, buddy. this is how it's gonna be. And so that in that transition, and letting them lead the way and own it is very important. From my outside perspective, the people we've seen that transition, that have made that transition that I've seen, either because of that training or because of the coaching they received from me or others, seem to be better at that. Or maybe I just didn't see the angst, but that's part of the journey. And so what you end up getting, if successful, is somebody that can give in the weeds tips when it's needed, but then, which is of huge value, but then, you know, steer at a practical level as opposed to somebody that can be snowballed and sandbagged or you know, tricked in some way, and has their, when they have those feet in the ground, we've seen it to be the best of the both worlds if they can get in that new mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like the way you roll it up with, what was it, idea, proposal,
and then decision.
Like, decision, right. That's powerful. And I've seen, you might have seen this in orgs where people adopt an etiquette in the subject field of the email, like response required.
Yes, exactly.
Versus, you know, anything else. And, you know, CEOs and higher up folks will parse their inbox for stuff like that first so they can really unblock the org. Right. But then things at the idea level, you may have a different tag for, still something to consider, but it's a priority kind of thing.
Yep.
Let's switch gears over to the wild card round. this is a bit of comic relief and in some cases even shock value, because I like talking about stories and not to just be negative, but in this case, it's about worst experiences, right? It's in hiring, right? We work so hard to get good talent on the way in the door. And I'm open to any stories from where you've interviewed somewhere back in the day, all the way up to interviews that you may have had without mentioning any specifics or names or whatever. But have you had any interesting interview experiences or candidate experiences, et cetera, to go into this segment with?
Yeah, I'm certainly most comfortable starting with myself. That's one of my leadership techniques is always if you're going to make fun of someone, start with yourself. And I think the one that comes to mind is that when I was interning, 2004, it was a super big deal at the time. Like, Google wasn't yet public, and I was interviewing there, as I was interviewing at IBM and a few other places. And, you know, it's like one of these, you know, fairly famous at this point, like all day things, probably six-ish people back to back. And this really squirrely guy was interviewing me. Just reminded me of the guy from Office Space with the stapler. And he asked me some algorithm question. And it was something like, you know, let's say you could predict, or you had the spreadsheet of the future of the stock market or something like that. You know, how would you maximize your return or something like that? And there's a fairly obvious way to do that. With like, it's back to big O or something like that, right? Like N squared sort of thing, and not as optimal as you want it. And the mistake I made was getting way too literal with like the C code that I was writing. I should have been much more abstract, and I just dove right into loops and whatnot. Either way, I didn't do as well as you could tell he wasn't particularly impressed with the situation. And I didn't move forward in that process. Fast forward to 2009 or so, you know, I was considering what was new after IBM, among others considering, starting something, and interviewed again at Google, this time in New York. And you know, I got the same question. So they've obviously got a stable of these things, and I wasn't sure. I had two problems at the moment I got that question. One, sort of a moral dilemma, like, is this fair? Should I mention that I've been told this question? But the second one was like a competency dilemma, which is like, I'd blocked out this whole experience that I just blocked it out so much that I never actually went back and solved it. Like, I just didn't want to think about it anymore.
Right.
So I didn't know how to react to this whole situation. I both wasn't sure I knew the answer. I'd learned a lot. I probably could have solved it. But I'd both blocked it out. And so I took the worst of both worlds, which is I said, some sort of truthfulness came up in me, and I said, I've had this before. And then he said something like, you know, do you know how to solve it? And I said, maybe. So that didn't go over well again. So like basically this one question, you know, killed any given Google. So there's some folder in Google that says like, this guy's interviewed twice and he does not learn from his mistakes. Probably a big X on at Google from you right now.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I mean, we've had similar responses in this series where it's even a little more of a ambush, and you're asked to solve puzzles or write some kind of native code that's not even applicable to how the company works.
Sure.
And so, you know, puzzles, traps, things that the people interviewing you have had months or years to think about, Especially right. like you said, they've been asking that question for 10 years. It becomes so rhetorical, and like some of the Microsoft questions, like, oh, you just touch the light bulb and see which one's hot. Like the answers become part of this subculture. Right. People that, you know, kind of know that. And in this series also, we've had recruiters that will leak the code sim in advance.
Right.
People who have had other people do their hacker ranks for them. It just goes down the line. And to me, that's not, a lot of that's not fair. The question they're asking there is somewhat fair if you're like literally just in the clouds, like talking out loud, like, well, I don't know, but here's how I would think about doing that is as your answer versus this is the answer. Because people, you know, some of the hardest problems take days and weeks sometimes, and you solve them in your sleep, you solve them in your shower time, you know, when you're just not thinking about the problem comes up again. And that's how some of the best work comes out of us at unknown times and fits and starts and so forth. Yeah, I mean, you said you wanted to start with yourself. On the other side of the table when you're interviewing people?
Yeah.
You know, any odd interview stories that you could share?
Yeah, so because of what you said, like, you know, to my knowledge, TaskRabbit's never asked a question about how many rocks there are in Mount Fuji or whatever it is, or why manhole covers are round, or there's this one about a bridge and somebody carries somebody across. I don't know. I got some of those too in Google and other processes. So we try to keep it tactical, like, you know, we're actually trying to build something, right? And one of those, and at the same time, it has to be relatable. It's, you know, we can't, you know, TaskRabbit builds a dynamic, you know, task recommendation system for who's best. Like, I'm not going to ask somebody to build this. It's something we've been working for years on. And so at least one question we've asked before is around tic-tac-toe. How would you model that in a database or something like that? And like, this is still on me, but like, you know, I'd draw a tic-tac-toe board and I'd say like, you know, how would we model this? And the guy kind of looked at me and it eventually became clear that he's never played this game before. You know, and it was a lesson for me in assumptions. Like his background did not include this, and so now I at the very least don't go into this sort of thing assuming that they know the game and this is the most obvious question in the world. I actually found myself in an interview like playing him in tic-tac-toe. It became a farce, just like the mountains in Mount Fuji or whatever. Did he think that we were actually, like, if he beat me in this new game, that he was going to get the job or something like that?
Right.
I was just trying to explain that there were 9 boxes. And so, like, you know, how many, are we going to have columns or 9 columns in this table? What are we going to do here? But like, you know, I go. Like it was, that was one experience. That comes to mind that sort of became a farce like those other ones.
Yeah, definitely. And in those scenarios, you give them an escape hatch where it's like, if you want to skip any question, just say so. We've got a whole bunch of them here. We'll go until you find one you could really like to answer quickly, you know?
Yeah, so at some point, after playing a few rounds, he enjoyed it, right? Like war games or something. We ended up, with more of a different question, basically. It became clear that this wasn't the way to go.
How about, do you have any stories with regards to recruiters, good, bad, or ugly?
Recruiters. There's one continuing on the same track of making fun of myself. So we hired an internal recruiter. I mean, I've gotten plenty of emails from recruiters that are absurd too, but like we hired an internal recruiter for the first time. And you know, we were talking and like, you know, it's good. Like she's going to, the first time we've had like a dedicated recruiter, and you know, we wouldn't pay someone 20% or whatever it was. So for when they brought someone in and all this, and this is good. We're ramping up, several years ago. And you know, at the time I was also going to meetups and all of these other things, to try to meet people and become a bigger part of the community. And these sort of things. And one of the things I told the recruiter that was okay to do was to send emails as me.
Oh yeah, right.
Because you know, like, seems like a good idea. Like, it would get a better response, basically. And I found that myself. If I send a personalized email, then, like, from the founder, et cetera, like, yeah, get a better reply rate. Definitely. What I did not foresee was the issue when I go to this meetup, and
people recall the conversations,
and
with
people
you,
right? are like, they're talking to me like they've been talking to me for a couple days. And, you know, I basically made myself look like a fool and a fraud at this meetup because I didn't know who this guy was. And, you know, subsequently stopped doing that.
Yeah. Yep. I went through that same phase as well, actually, believe it or not. And I played it off in this sort of disheveled mad scientist way, like, oh, you know, I mean, it's partly true. I broke my wrist so bad. I was doing talent for about 2 years straight and I had to be on the phone and things. And that exact thing happened to me, but it's just, yeah, it's less genuine. I mean, the response rates, you're right, as a co-founder or whatever, are really high because especially if you're doing full cycle or a smaller company, you're doing first contact all the way to offer or whatever.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Have you ever hired any outside agencies that either did or did not work for you?
Yeah. So, yeah, over the years, certainly plenty that some that worked the first time, some that worked a couple times, some that never worked. You know, I guess what I found is, you know, I mean, I still get, I don't know, 10 plus emails when I wake up in the morning from somebody, you know, that's got this great candidate that, you know, that went to MIT or Stanford or something, or that was at Google or Apple or whatever. One of the things I've learned is that those first three candidates they give you is the best they're ever going to give you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause they've been working on that pipe. Like that they had, it's the best they have. From then on out, it's going to be whatever they're trickling in. And so, like, in particular, if those first three aren't very good, that they've had the pipeline to build up for the last month, you know, the ongoing isn't going to be so good. And, you know, it's really important how they represent you.
Totally. It's
really important if you've got a few of those and internal, or just in general, more than, it's the same story as I just had. If you have more than one human dealing with this, like, how do we not email the same person twice? Like, otherwise it's like, we look like we don't have our shit together. We look like we're desperate. If they said no to one person, like if they get a recruiter, like, please leave me alone. Like we have to respect that. Yeah. And yet you're one of 2,000 people that have experience, you know, with Ruby on Rails and MySQL or whatever keywords we're using in the Bay Area. And so, you know, eventually it's going to come around again. And how do we be respectful and represent our brand well and who we want to be, which is neighborly by our own values?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say where it breaks down for me with respect to good versus shoddy recruiters is along the lines of what you just said. A, how do they represent you? Because kind of part of the code of conduct for these recruiters is a really good published code of ethics in the UK on this, where if you're a recruiter, you have to like swear to it or whatever. But it's a one sheet. It's really short. And it has to do with, like, among many things, like you as a recruiter, you're representing the company by introducing that to the candidate early on, because maybe they've already talked to him. Or in my case, I had recruiters that sent me CVs of people who were some of my friends. So I know they didn't represent it, right? Because they kept the candidate in dark, right? So there's a two-sided marketplace. How are they representing? How transparent are they? Because I learned after these CVs were shipped to me that they were naked shorts. They were positions they didn't even have, which they were selling me because the person's not really in market. So a lot of my gripes break down along the lines of, like you said, like recruiters will send you a CV, sometimes redacted or not, like, hey, look at all the good people we have in hand. Don't you want to get on contract with us? And then you peel the layers back and realize they don't even represent those people in some cases. And I fired an agency for essentially going naked on the submission because the person's not even in market. Like, I could go like call the phone book or canvas my network or whatever we do to source. But if you're sending me people that aren't even really actively looking to jump, like, what is your value in that regard? And so that a lot of my own horror stories break down along those lines because, you know, they were really bad. In fact, my other quick one is when I was at Crux, people would call the front office or the front line. And, you know, we were an ad tech company, so you never dial engineers. We didn't even have phones on our desks. Mm-hmm. And a recruiter out of the blue would call and try and poach us from where we work, from the front line, the front office, you know, is that that aggressive back then, you know, still kind of is, you know.
Crux Digital, how may I help you? Can we speak to your best iOS engineer,
please? Yeah. Exactly.
That's something. One thing that I did that helped save time if for people that do go down this road is, you know, everyone's sending you their own contract or something. At some point I just made up my own contract.
Yep.
And said, like, you know, here's the deal.
Yeah, I mean, everybody wants
to include whatever works, right?
Yeah, everybody wants 25% and you round down and you say everybody else is signing at this, here you go. And the one thing that gripes me about recruiters in general, and this is why they will put you on blast with CVs sometimes, they get a lockup usually for a year, right? So if they submit someone to you in February, you pass because they're not a fit, but then you have a new role where they are within that 12 months. They can come back to you if you hire them. It's buried in everybody's clause usually. They have a lockup for a year, and that's why you don't want them going roughshod over, you know, submitting you too many that aren't fits or whatever, because technically they will come back and get that money. It's free money for them. Yeah. So you got to be careful. And then you also have to be wary of, like, who's really representing someone. I've had multiple CVs come in within minutes of each other, represented by two different agencies that we are on contract with. And then literally we have to, like, go into the JSON of the, in our applicant tracking system to see the real timestamps, you know, to see who got in first or whatever. Cause there's no sword in the ATS or whatever. And, that's another thing, you know, candidates who are in market, these recruiters talk to each other between agencies because there's a whole gossip network that goes on, which has its own effects. But yeah, anyhow, I've seen basically people jump on people and submit. And the thing is, they weren't representing that person yet. They were trying to get them to get their business. So they front-run the opportunity, basically. Anyhow, it goes on and on and on. But I guess where you can see where I'm going with this is that there's some good ones, there's some bad ones. I say the best that I've seen truly build relationships with, like, mid and senior level type engineer folks, and, like, take them out to a hockey game one-on-one, and, like, dinners, and, like, the best recruiters I know, at least in LA, it's a list I can count on half of one hand, really, actually. Yeah. So, Brian, thanks for taking the time today. You have a really interesting arc through your career, and it's kind of unique because a lot of folks are advancing in their career. Like, you know, they might be somewhere 2, 3, 4 years is even a long time. But as your role as a technical co-founder with TaskRabbit, sounds like you're about 9 or 10 years into it. And it's a really cool set of circumstances because you're actually an outlier in this cohort. And so I appreciate all the stories you've shared today and some of the insights that you've given. It's been great.
Yeah, I didn't get to Dave to the newest punchline for me is that that I'm transitioning at TaskRabbit to an advisor, and I'll probably be starting something new soon.
Oh, great! Congratulations.
So, thank you. So, you know, 10 years is a long time, and I am still going to be involved, you know, on the periphery and every so often to help the team, but. I'm excited to try something new soon too.
Excellent. Well, we'll be excited to see what you start next. And so thanks again for joining. It was a great conversation, and look forward to the next time we can chat.
Yeah, thank you.